everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, the congenial co-host, Jeff Bowden. With me, my co-host, Barry Rose from lovely Amber. Is it Amber or Ambler? No, it's not an Ambler alert. It's Ambler, PA. It's my man, Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing today?
It is Ambler. So, Jeff, if you are congenial, what would that make me?
I don't know. Some people on the Arcadian Network say they're congenial. You know, opinions vary. I'm just... So on this show, we don't just break kayfabe on Ambler PA. We break kayfabe on sports, movies, pop culture, television. But today, is it a very special edition, do you think, Barry, of a Breaking Kayfabe?
It's a very special edition of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry today. And I'm very excited about it. We are going to discuss what has been voted the number one CWF angle in the history of the promotion, which has actually been gone now, Jeff, for 32 years. The promotion has been closed. But we also have a special guest who was there when this angle took place. So it's this is one of these episodes that you're not going to want to miss. You don't want to walk out of the room. You want to call your friends. You want to call your neighbors. You want everybody tuned into some sort of streaming device to hear what's going to take place this episode. So, Jeff, I'm super excited.
Are you going old Blackjack Mulligan here? Call Mama in from the back porch. Have her come listen. You know, so we got lots to talk about. This is going to be a fun episode. Do we want to break kayfabe on who we got with us here?
No, I know I don't. I don't know what you think, but
all right, well,
I know I don't.
We're going to hold our cards here like any good poker player, and we're going to wait to reveal who the big guest is. So before we get there, though, we have a few things we need to discuss. We're going to be talking about all things CWF related here today. We're going to be talking about the big angle. We're going to be taking a look at the DVD that we mentioned last week and get some people's thoughts on that. However, before we do, we need to recognize a couple things. First of all, Barry, as I pointed out to you yesterday, as we record this, it is the day after the anniversary of the untimely passing of an absolute legend, Gordon Solie. And so we remember Gordon and his family, his daughter Pam, his son Gennard, and Gordon. It's always a Gordon. Barry! We're starting off real good here. It's always a sad day to remember when we lost the dean of professional wrestling, the Walter Cronkite of pro wrestling, Gordon Solie.
Yeah, it is, too. And it's, you know, Gordon is one of those guys, too. And he, you know, the last few years of his life, he was not in great shape. But I met Gordon, I think, two or three times. I never got the chance to spend a lot of time with him. And this is a lot of people did, you know, Howard Baum talks about his time spent with Gordon. And, you know, Gordon was one of these guys, if he was still with us, I would want to, you know, certainly would be at one of the fan fest, if not every fan fest. But at the same time, I always wanted to, you know, if I could list five guys that I want to sit down and maybe have a drink or two or a steak or something like that, you know, be able to spend quality time with them. Gordon was right at the top. And obviously, based off of my history with CWF, I'm extremely biased, and I get that. But Gordon truly was the greatest of all time, and that's not a knock. You know, that's what it always comes into. Well, fuck if you say that. Well, Lance Russell was the best. It's not a knock on anybody else. Gordon was in a league and a class. And look, it just doesn't happen. We were just lucky that we had Gordon at the end of the day, because if Gordon had been somewhere else, he still would have been the best that there ever was. So it isn't that I just grew up listening to Gordon, but if you go back and you listen to matches from the 1970s and Gordon is calling them, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable at that stage that we're talking 40 years ago and maybe even, you know, 45 years ago, that type of quality broadcasting was taking place on a wrestling event. Go listen to the WWF or, God forbid, Stampede with Ed Whalen. But, you know, look, Gordon was in a class by himself. And really, how many, you know, there, in my opinion, there's only a few announcers that are really identified with a promotion. Like, you know, you say Gordon Solie, Florida, obviously. Lance Russell, Memphis, without a doubt. Bill Mercer in Dallas. But, you know, what about the rest? You know, Paul Bosch in Houston, even though he was the promoter. So to me, Gordon is the personification of professional wrestling broadcasters. He really was at a different level than anybody else before or after, because what takes place now, at least in my opinion, is you've got guys that are professional broadcasters. You've got guys that have been trained in broadcasting, and it's different. You know, Gordon was a guy that I don't know if he had any sort of training. I think it was all on-the-job training, and he used to call races. There was the Speedway. It was the Golden Gate Speedway in the Tampa area, and that's how they actually picked him. And he was, I believe, even the Speedway manager at one point, and started broadcasting wrestling. And he took over for a guy, Jeff, named Salty Saul Fleischman. Have you ever heard this story before?
Oh, of course. I've heard all his broadcasts. Salty Saul, he was a legend here. No, of course not.
Of course. Well, let's say it's literally probably like during the period when you and I were being born. But so Salty Saul was he was a fisherman first and foremost, I think, and he is a Tampa legend. He's been gone for years, and he was a guy that had his own article in the newspaper. He would do Salty Saul's fishing report. I have a bunch of copies of these, and this was going back to like the 50s, maybe even the 40s, and. He had been around, you know, he's a Tampa guy. He was doing a morning show in Tampa at one point on, I think it was WFLA. So he was kind of like, you know, you remember like Chuck Zink, you know, we had Skipper Chuck.
Oh, yeah, Skipper Chuck, yeah.
Salty Saul really wasn't for kids per se, but he was this friendly host. He always wore a captain's hat, big guy, had a nice mustache, big burly mustache, and he was the personification of a local celebrity for a market. This was the guy. So he was the original wrestling announcer before Gordon was. And there was a team, which you are familiar with, was Kurt and Carl von Brauner with gentleman Saul Weingeroff. And Salty Saul Fleischman, being of Jewish religion, was very offended by the von Brauners and gentleman Saul Weingeroff, and actually quit out of that. And that's how Gordon, who then came over from the racetrack, started calling. So it's a real history right there. But, you know, he is... I toss around the word legend like it's fucking Fritos. You know, everybody and their mother can be a legend, and I get that. And Jody Simon has a huge issue with anybody who does that. But you know, the truth is, when you say legend, Gordon Solie really was. He truly was a legend in professional wrestling broadcast. And you know, even if you were debating who the best was or not, there's no way you're not saying that Gordon isn't in the top three of all time. Again, he's number one in my opinion, strictly my opinion, doesn't mean a thing, but he would have to be in the top three, no matter what anybody says.
You know, as I was sitting there thinking, first of all, wasn't Gordon a broadcaster when he was in the military? Like, didn't he do like some radio work or something like that? Yeah. So
right about that. Yeah.
But I was sitting there thinking, it's interesting the way that guys that are regarded as the really good broadcasters, okay, are guys that are always seemingly intertwined with at least one figure during their career, the way that Gordon and Dusty were intertwined, the way that Jim Ross is seemingly intertwined with Steve Austin. You know, you're talking about Lance Russell with Jerry Lawler. And, you know, even guys like Bob Caudle or David Crockett, they're intertwined in my mind with Jim Cornette and the interplay those guys used to have, and even Tony Schiavone, and you know, Vince and Gene Okerlund with Hogan. So much of what, you know, like Gene Okerlund made his bones was that stuff with Hulk Hogan. And it was funny because the other day I was just watching, someone had posted the link to when the night of the big turn with Hogan and how Okerlund came out there. And one of the things he said was, you know, I've been with you for over 15 years and I can't believe you're doing that. And, you know, there again, you're showing the crowd the connection that those two individuals had. And that's what Gordon had with Dusty, with Jim Ross had with Steve Austin. And, you know, as I've said, you know, you can go different parts of the country to guys that are, you know, the really good broadcasters, always seemingly intertwined with one of the guys that was really a breakout star in that area.
Yeah, that's such a good point too, because again, you know, Gordon and Dusty and Jerry Lawler and Lance Russell and, you know, and Bill Mercer and every Von Erich, but yeah, you're right too. And Okerlund is defined by his relationship with Hogan, you know, because he was right there and it was, you know, Mean Gene and that whole thing. And yeah, that's an excellent point that I never really thought of.
Well, I like to think every once in a while I can do a little something. Yeah, you know, you stumble upon something. So here's a question that I have for you. And, you know, we'll offer this question to our guest when our guest joins us, Barry. So everyone talks about a Mount Rushmore for this or that. You can be doing sports, movies, television. So let's take CWF and let's look at the Mount Rushmore of CWF. And I'm going to throw three names that I think have to be on that Mount Rushmore. You tell me, give me five choices for the fourth and final spot, and then tell me who you think it should be, the fourth person on that mountain, okay?
Yes, sir.
So if I go CWF Mountain, Mount Everest, I'm going to go Eddie Graham.
Mount Everest. We're doing Mount Everest or Mount Rushmore?
Let's get back to Mount Rushmore.
Wait a minute.
Lou, you're going to have to do some fucking post-editing, my man. So let's take a look at the CWF Mount Rushmore here. So I'm going to go with Dusty, Eddie Graham, and Gordon Solie. So tell me, give me five guys that should be on
Jeff,
the
you're, – Jeff, this is a day that you want to play the lottery. So you're 100% right, Jeff, which I don't think I've said in a couple weeks. So to backtrack on this, about 5 or 6 years ago, I created a virtual CWF Hall of Fame. And the beauty of the CWF Hall of Fame is it's almost a legitimate Hall of Fame because people get very upset and angry when the people that they feel that should be in the Hall of Fame are not voted in. And it causes me grief because I will get messages, this isn't right, this person should be in before this guy. And eventually I'm like, you know, fuck this, because it's a headache. That being said, Jeff, I actually inducted for the Hall of Fame 5 people, and they were 5 honorary inductions. There was no vote. It was strictly people that I believe these were the first 5 that should go in. And the 3 names that you just said, Jeff, were 3 of the 5 names that went in. So you said Eddie Graham, Dusty Rhodes, and Gordon Solie, correct?
Correct.
Who would be the other 2 names that would go in there? What would you think? So this is, I mean, I'm agreeing with you, so you're right. Those 3 names are absolutely the Mount Everest or Rushmore of CWF. But so the other 2 names, who would the other 2 names? And think, so try to think, one is just try to think of a star. The other one, think of the importance of CWF.
Now, let me ask you a question here.
Sure.
Am I doing this from the way you think or the way other people would think?
Okay, that's an excellent point. So the way that I would think is from a historical perspective. So if this isn't like, you know, like putting like Tyree Pride in. Not a knock on Tyree, Jeff, but this isn't a question of
maybe other candidates we could think of.
Yeah, but this isn't a popularity contest. This is from a historical perspective based off of accomplishments, who deserves
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you 3 names that I think the 2 should be coming from. If I'm thinking like Lord Barron's Rose, I'm going to go Great Malenko, Jack Briscoe, Hiro Matsuda.
So very good. So one of those 3 is, the other 2 were part of the first voted in class. So they deserve to be. It's Jack Briscoe's in. So, you look at Jack Briscoe, you look at what was accomplished, started off working for Leroy McGurk in the tri-state area, switched to Florida at still relatively a young stage of his career, and the rest is history. And he really, you know, Briscoe was the guy for so many years. And, you know, again, we've talked about this. There are 3 baby faces that really carried the promotion: Eddie Graham, Dusty Rhodes, Jack Briscoe, or Eddie Graham, Jack Briscoe, Dusty Rhodes, like in that order. So Jack Briscoe does. Malenko and Matsuda were voted in the first class and should be based off of their accomplishments. That last name, Jeff, is Cowboy Lutcher.
Yeah, it just popped into my head. I was going to say,
because at the end of the day, if you're not, you know, Cowboy Luttrell, he set the stage for this to happen. A guy came down and, basically built CWF, took in Eddie Graham, and between the 2 of them, you know, it's considered one of the best territories in the history of wrestling. So that's where I would go, and that's where I did go, Jeff.
Yeah, okay, and that's definitely fair points. I think you have made an argument there. So now let me ask you another question as we're talking about the American Dream here. Tell me, give me 3 to 5 names, because there's a lot of people you could mention here, and then give me the person that you think would be number 1 if I ask you to say in CWF, not in Georgia, not anywhere else, in CWF, give me 5 guys that were Dusty Rhodes' greatest rival.
I love that question too. So Pak Song, Terry Funk, The Assassin, Superstar Billy Graham, Missouri Mahler.
Really? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Last one kind of surprising me there. But now, out of those five guys, tell me the one guy that when you look back at all that history for CWF, you say, yeah, that was the guy. That was Dusty's greatest rival.
It's Terry Funk. It's we posted this question maybe a year or two ago in the group, and opinions varied, you know, as they do with any of these types of questions. But historically speaking, looking at the length of that feud, which really started in 1976 when Dusty decided to chase the NWA title that Funk held at the time, and that feud went up until up until the early 80s. Kevin Sullivan's another name. You know, I always tend to think 70s and something, but Kevin Sullivan and Dusty Rhodes in the 80s were, you know, I don't know, what, 3, 4, 5 years, something like that. So those are the best. I'm always going to associate him with Terry Funk, and I think partly it was based off of Terry Funk's interviews. Because Terry Funk would do those interviews, the egg-sucking dog, you're yellow, all the shit that people remember and actually quote was stuff that Terry Funk was saying about him. But I would say, again, if I'm breaking it down, I'm going to say Terry Funk in the 70s, Kevin Sullivan in the 80s. Ernie Ladd was another great one. It just didn't come to fruition. I did pull out the Missouri Mahler, which surprised you, and they had two feuds, which would be 76 and 79, and the one in 76 – they feuded for months, 3 months, 4 months, bloodbaths, Jeff. And look, Mahler and Rhodes were never afraid of blood, the blade and bleeding and juicing. But the professor, Pete Lederberg, has got some photos of the Missouri Mahler. And it's just, you just have to see it to believe the bloodbath that was occurring right there. So I would go Terry Funk. I believe Dusty Rhodes, or I should say Billy, Superstar Billy Graham has claimed that Dusty Rhodes said that his greatest opponent ever was Superstar Billy Graham. I don't know that to be fact, but it may be.
Yeah, and certainly there's no wrong. It's funny because, you know, because we are nothing if not research orientated. I will have you know that today, as I was searching out our topic that we will be discussing for the best CWF angle, I also stumbled upon the angle that you mentioned last week where Ernie Ladd turned in Miami. And lo and behold, there was, and the voiceover by Ernie Ladd was just, oh my God, it was just gold, where he's talking about, you know, by the way, Gordon, I don't know if you know this, but I was the highest paid lineman in the NFL when I left. And then, you know, he's, oh, Dusty Rhodes down on the floor and he's signing autographs, and he's making the motion in the ring about signing autographs. And oh my God, it was so good. And Ernie Ladd was just so great as the obnoxious heel interview. And he looked like he was having the time of his life.
Yeah, Ernie Ladd was, and we've said this before also, Jeff, but Ernie Ladd was 10, 15, or 20 years too early, because even today, he was so good with his promos. He was good in the ring, but man, his promos were money, and he was doing and saying stuff that nobody else was doing at the time. So that's such a great, you know, Mr. Announcer, what are you doing? You're trying to doctor up the footage? You know,
that didn't happen that night.
Right. That's awesome. I mean, it's revolutionary for 1977 when you stop and think about it. So
this is like a Watergate fantastic thing.
It's a Watergate situation. Exactly. I mean, who comes up with that? Ernie Ladd, that was man. Good. Fantastic.
So let's veer away from CWF, sort of, because a little bit of controversy on the old Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook group. No, not the one you think that I'm going to talk about. Before we get to that topic, let's talk about the big issue on the board this week. Bobby Van Kevlar has lost the beard. Oh, my God. People were stunned, Barry.
People were stunned. And if you go and you read the comments on that post in the group, it is absolutely hysterical. Those comments are great. And Bobby, clearly one of the nicer people we'll ever meet, Jeff, takes it all in stride, loves it, thinks the jokes are hysterical, and I spoke with him yesterday. He was actually showing that post to his wife and daughters, and they were all cracking up, and they were all laughing. But Bobby has promised that the Amish beard would be making a return appearance on November the 9th for CWF Legends Fan Fest 6. So I'm fingers are crossed, Jeff.
Yeah, he's got a lot of work to do to get that beard back in Amish shape.
It does.
Yeah. So okay. So now let's talk about what you were thinking I was going to be referring to. We recently had some other posts food related, and Barry, I think it got you a bit kerfluffled as people were actually putting over Dunkin' Donuts and the Outback.
Yeah. So Edgar, and my Spanish is not great. Edgar Muniz Jr. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Jeff? Muniz.
I believe you are, sir.
All right. So Edgar says, I'm not saying it's the best donuts in the world. And Edgar, really, I mean, if you have no other point of reference, if it's the only donut you've ever had, then sure it is. But for Barry Rose to say Dunkin' is cardboard with frosting is way over the line. So last week I had some very harsh words for Dunkin' Donuts. And really, a lot of it was directed at me. I was very angry with myself because previously I had mentioned that, you know, whenever somebody says the donuts suck but the coffee's good, I'll always come forth with, yeah, the coffee's not bad. The coffee sucks. The coffee is as bad as the fucking donuts are. The fact that anybody wastes their money in these shitholes, God bless you if this is what you like, but there's got to be better options where you are. So I do agree with Edgar, but I do want to apologize in that I think I insulted cardboard, because cardboard called me and said, we fucking taste 100 times better than the shit that they use for fucking Dunkin' Donuts. So I want to take that into account, but there were some nice comments on there. James Young, I'm with Barry on this one. Dunkin' is just a mediocre donut. I'm sorry, James, it is not. It is shit. It sucks. Jeff Bowdrin checking in with a Big Lebowski meme saying, over the line. Mike Mindless, donuts are cheaply made with peanut oil. They give me heartburn now. When I was a kid, my dad knew the new ones were made about 10:30, and I could eat 5 fresh ones still warm. And we should say that, too. As a kid, I liked Dunkin' Donuts, and whether my tastes have changed or the quality of the product has gone down dramatically, which is really what a lot of I think it is. But Dunkin' Donuts 30, 40 years ago, I think, was absolutely fine. I used to love those strawberry frosted ones. And actually, Eric Miller, Dunkin' Donuts used to be good when I was a kid. I remember looking through a window they had in the back, yada, yada, yada. I think the cardboard frosting is pretty darn accurate. And lastly, William Merriweather checking in, they're garbage. I mean, I'll eat them because I'm fat, but they really do suck. And Fritz Grandi, he hates baseball. Also hates Dunkin' Donuts. Straight garbage. You're not changing my mind on this one. However, if you like Dunkin' Donuts, more power to you. You know, America
Fritz,
runs
Fritz
on
Fritz has
Dunkin'.
A lot of anger because he hates a lot
Fritz
of shit.
Sounds like shit. Fritz hates baseball and donuts, Dunkin' Donuts. But Jeff, so something that you had brought up at dinner that you had. And you had mentioned Outback and how you just felt it really went down. And there was actually several people defending, and including Jamie Ward, and Jamie Ward making the analogy that a Longhorn had opened up near them and Outback had to step up their game to compete. But why don't we quantify that? And quite frankly, it's not really accurate. Now, I'll tell you why, because Outback is not a decision. It's a company. It's owned by Landry, and it's not a decision that's made per the location. So if Outback is going to do something, that decision is made in Tampa, and then it's rolled out to all the Outbacks nationally. So it's not like an Outback in Coral Springs is going to go, holy fuck, Longhorn Steakhouse opened up across the street. We got to step up our game. It just doesn't work like that. So maybe as a company, maybe they did. And I used to like Outback. We've talked about it before. Outback years ago was a place I look forward to going to. Just my last couple of experiences have not been good. I will say that there are restaurants where, you know, you can go to a Carrabba's 20 minutes from me and it might suck, but there might be a Carrabba's in Los Angeles that might be just fucking through the roof. A lot of that's going to be management. It's going to be quality control and product management, et cetera, and a whole bunch of factors go into it. So there are Outbacks out there that are probably good. Unfortunately, Jeff, you and I have not dined at those.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Think about when you first go to, you know, let's just say for the sake of this argument, a chain restaurant. Okay, you go to Outback, Carrabba's, whatever. The first time you go to it, you sit there and you say to yourself, this is pretty good. You know, I could see myself coming back there. And I find myself finding these places And I'll give you an example. For our lovely anniversary dinner, Mrs. Bowdrin and I went to J. Alexander's. You familiar with this chain, Barry?
And let me tell you right now, you could do no wrong at J. Alexander. It's very good.
Well, unfortunately for you, Mr. and Mrs. Bowdrin found that you could, because the one we go to, an exclusive Boca Raton, Florida. By the way, more plastic surgery in that place every time we go than any place I've ever seen in my life. But we went there, and we've always had a very pleasant dining experience there, okay? Last time we went there, I got the Hawaiian steak, and I found it was a good steak, a little fatty, okay? So then I decided to get the prime rib, and the prime rib was okay. The baked potato came out. Baked potato, warm, not hot, which I didn't like that. But then we asked for bread. Now, they normally do not bring bread out with their dinner entrees unless the waiter told us you ask for it, okay? So the bread comes out. It's sourdough. It's got a hard crust. I don't mind a hard crust, okay? But as I'm biting into the bread is stale, Barry. And I'm like, what the F is this? The bread is stale? And so at the end of the meal, I told the waiter about this. I said, am I missing something? Do you guys prep this bread different? And he goes, no, it's sourdough bread. And I said, that might be the key because, wow, this is a really stale tasting piece of bread. And, you know, I said, I just thought maybe you guys prepped it differently or something. And he apologized all over himself. And I said, look, it's not your fault. You're just you're the server. You're not the guy out there making the bread. And I'm sure they don't make the bread there. I'm sure it's delivered by some local baking. But yeah, this bread had been sitting on the shelf, I'm guessing, for at least a few days. And so that was really disappointing. And we got the prime rib, and the prime rib was good, but it wasn't, you know, $35 good. And, you know, so we weren't spending $80, $90 on a steak, but, you know, we spent $30 to $35. And you think that the steak is going to be better than a Longhorn, for instance, okay? And quite frankly, it was good, but I told my wife, I go, the last couple times we've been to J. Alexander, a little bit disappointed. That being said, I've tried, and Barry, have you ever tried the, I'm going to have to try to think of the name of the place. It's the pork medallions in a special kind of glaze. Have you ever tried those?
I've never tried them there. I've had them other places.
Yeah, and every time I try it at J. Alexander's, it's very strong, really good. But anyway, let's get back to Outback here. So let me read the thread that was started on our Facebook group. Completely lost my train of thought there. Stephen Javorski says, breaking kayfabe in Outback. I got to say, I went to one last week in Egg Harbor Township, New Jersey, and it was great. I am sure Barry Rose knows the area. It was a new building. The service is great. I got the ribeye, baked potato, and mac and cheese. The only minor complaint was there was too much pepper on the mac and cheese. Other than that, it was a fine dining experience. So we have a few comments here. Bart Springer says, Outback is my favorite place to go. Never been disappointed. Apparently, Bart does not live in South Florida. Ariel Agbalog says, I've never had a bad experience there either. I love the fact that you can have the ribeye cut as large as you want. Who is this guy? A bald-headed guy named Barry Rose says, I love black pepper on mac and cheese. What kind of weirdo freak is that guy? Stephen Javorski said, it wasn't bad. I'm not a big pepper fan in general, but it was more than I would have liked. LOL. And then Jamie Ward. Yeah, Jamie, you got a comment about how, you're all into the Outback and stuff. Fine, you're an Eagles fan. Who fucking cares? But Justin Pratt then says, New York Strip without fail every time for me, and they're always amazing. They've actually better than a lot of private steakhouses. What? Around here outside the high-end ones like Charlie's and Burns. They are comparing Outback to Charlie's and Burns, Barry. Have at them.
Yeah, so so when I saw that too, in his defense, what he's saying is they're good. They're not at the level of a Charlie. Now, Charlie's Steakhouse, I don't know if you've ever been. They're great. They're throughout Central. They're in Orlando. They are in Tampa. Mrs. Rose, some 23 years ago, actually worked for a Charlie's Steakhouse on International Drive in Orlando. So I'm very familiar. But Burns, Jeff, we had a fantastic dinner a couple of years back. It was myself, it was you, the lovely Mrs. Bowdrin, Belinda Luttrell, and her husband was there. And who am I leaving out? I know I'm leaving out Bruce Cohen. Was Bruce Cohen at that one?
I think he might have been. I was going to say BVK, but I don't think he was there. But Bruce Cohen, as a matter of fact, absolutely was.
Yeah, I remember we went up to the dessert room. Burns Steakhouse is at a different level. Everything was at the service, the food, everything was. Again, you like Outback. I say more power to you. Comparing it to Burns and Charlie's, a Capital Grill, Ruth Chris, Morton's, Sullivan's, that I don't know about. But you know what, Jeff, maybe I need to get to an Outback. We are recording. I am going to go out to dinner tonight. Maybe I should just mosey on over, get a Bloomin' Onion, get a steak, and, you know, I don't know. What do you think?
I think if you're going to go and take that chance, go with the Alice Springs chicken. That's all I'm going to say. So right. Before we go to our big CWF reunion with a star that was there the night of the number one angle in the history of the promotion, Barry, do you know what time it is?
I don't. What time is it?
Well, actually, it's about 5:45. But
okay,
what I was going to reference was that it's time for a little F, marry, or kill. Are you ready, my man?
Wow. Very excited. Absolutely.
And I'm throwing this on you as a little surprise. So last week we referenced a certain movie, one that you thought was pretty good, I thought was pretty horrible, Cat People. So I'm going to include two of the female stars that we discussed last week. Plus, I'm going to throw another, I want to say early 80s, late 70s kind of legend there, Barry. So we're going to go three ladies. I'm giving you Nastassia Kinski, Annette O'Toole, or Catherine Bach from the Dukes of Hazzard. Boom. Oh. Go, Barry.
That's a tough one right there because they're all effable. They're all marryable, and not one is a real that stands out. You have to kill somebody. I am going to – I got to admit, I had the biggest crush on Nastassia Kinski, so I'm going to marry her with the hopes that I could just F 24/7. So I'm going to marry her. I am going to F Catherine Bach, and I'm going to kill Annette O'Toole, which really is not fair because Annette O'Toole was super spectacular back then. That's a tough one, Jeff. There's no clear, you know, there's no clear right or wrong on that.
Well, I'm going to say you are wrong because I am going to change that up. Because I have to admit, although she's an absolutely beautiful woman, I never really thought Catherine Bach was super special. Boy, I can just see the board lighting up now when I said that. I mean, she was a beautiful woman, but not like, I don't know, not at that Nastassia Kinski level. So I'm going to F the hell out of Nastassia Kinski. I'm going to marry me some Annette O'Toole because that's a good, solid woman right there who's also beautiful as the day is long. I got to be honest with you, you're right, Perry. Not a thorn in amongst these roses, not at all.
Not at all, too. That's really, really tough. And you just said marry Annette O'Toole. You know she's married, right? You and I discussed this.
We discussed this last week. Yes, we did.
Yeah, she is married to the lovely Lenny from Lenny and Squiggy, Michael McKean, Spinal Tap and 50 other million shows, Breaking Bad, obviously. And Jeff, I got to say, I know that we're going to be discussing Stranger Things shortly. Wow, what a season. The show, in my opinion, Jeff, has only gotten better. Fantastic. 4 stars all the way across the board.
Okay, but before we go to that and before we go to our special interview, I'm going to ask you one last question because I love a good topic, and I forgot to throw this one at you last week, Barry. This is the kind of stuff that's going to make riveting conversation, okay? I'm going to give credit to John Fell for posting this. I'm not sure if it was on our board or on the one of the other boards that I go to, John McAdams, Pro Wrestling, whatever. But a very compelling question that I think the world is waiting for Barry Rose to give an answer to. Barry, you ready?
I'm ready.
You're standing at a urinal. You're taking care of a little number one business, right? Gentleman next to you, let's say for the sake of argument, he's a stranger.
Okay.
He drops an air biscuit right there with you standing next to him. Do you react? And if so, how do you react?
So it did happen.
This is an important question.
Yeah, it is an important question, too. Well, I think it's – is it appropriate? I mean, in a sense, it's appropriate. At least you're in a bathroom where that – you know, these types of functions actually occur. That has happened to me previously, and I think I said something. I said, oh, yeah, I was just watching Blazing Saddles. So I think that was my reaction to it. Let me ask you a question, Jeff. This is one. You ever see this movie Waiting with Ryan Reynolds? It's a hysterical movie. It's about life in a restaurant. Have you ever seen the movie?
I don't know if I've seen the entire thing, but I have seen parts of it. Yes.
Right. It's our boy. What's his name? Lewis. Jesus Christ. I can't remember what the guy's name is. Anyway, this movie is hysterical, but there's a scene in the movie where the guy's taking a piss and the guy next to him kind of leans over to get a look at his dick. And it causes the guy that he's not able to urinate in public any longer. He can only pee in his house. He can only go on it. So have you ever been in a bathroom where you think some guy was kind of leaning or stretching to maybe get a look at your junk?
I can honestly say that has never happened to Mr. Bowdrey.
There you go. Same here. It's never happened. I haven't disappointed anyone.
Why should they see our shortcomings, right, Barry?
Exactly right. Thank God I wasn't able to disappoint somebody. But, Jeff, in looking at our clock, I think it might be time, Jeff. Is it time?
It's time. Not for F, Mary, and Kill. We already did that.
Oh, that's true.
All right. So right now we're going to go to our special interview segment with a CWF legend that was there the night that the number one angle in the history of Florida took place. So why don't we talk to that guy now, Barry?
Let's do it.
So who better to join us to discuss this number one angle? And folks, we are big surprise. I'm sure everyone is shocked to hear that the number one angle on Barry's CWF page was the turning of Dusty Rhodes the night against the evil Korean Pak Song and Gary Hart. So we decided to reach out. Barry, how cool is it? Kevin Sullivan here joining us. Sully, how you doing, man?
Great. How are you guys?
We're doing well. Thank you for joining us and talking a little Dusty Rhodes turning and setting the place on fire.
Yes, he did. I think that was the second biggest turn of all times in the wrestling business. The
you
first
give
one
us
being Hogan.
Hogan turning and joining the NWO?
Yeah.
I just referenced that turn about 5 minutes ago. So let's set the groundwork. We're talking May 14th, 1974. We're at the Fort Hesterly Armory in Tampa, Florida. 6,000 people there to see Eddie and Mike Graham take on Dusty Rhodes and Pak Song, the Korean from Korea, as Dusty would say during the talkover segment on TV, and Gary Hart at ringside. Sully, what do you remember from that night?
Well, this had been building up for a while. It was almost impossible. Even if you wanted to keep Dusty heel, you weren't going to be able to do it. The people were cheering for him, and he had two of the greatest foils of all times, Gary Hart and Pak Song Nam. And you got to remember, the Vietnam War is still continuing. There was no other place in the world, wrestling world, as Florida to keep something legit. And Dusty, son of a plumber, his interview started to tilt a little from heel to babyface. And it blew the roof off. The people knew he was going to turn. It was just a matter of time. And they teased it enough that they thought it was going to turn earlier, and he didn't. And then they did it out of nowhere. There wasn't any tip-off that he was going to turn that night. And, of course, you know, people, we hear everybody in the wrestling business say, you know, it was sold out, they're hanging from the rafters. But I remember going to Miami after he turned babyface, and there were scalpers selling ringside tickets for $150, $200, which was unheard of. So, I mean, he was a phenomenon that comes across once in an era, and he was fabulous.
So, Barry?
Yeah, so, and he's absolutely right, too. So the story that I had always heard was that it was this was something that had been building for weeks. And if you look at the team of Dusty Rhodes and Pak Song, they only teamed together maybe three or four times over like a 3 week period. And it was mostly on television, obviously, to get the most exposure. So this was a team that was put together with Gary Hart, obviously, being the manager so that they could break up. And Sullivan, Kevin, the story that I always heard was that Eddie Graham would come out to the arena when Dusty was wrestling and he wouldn't look at the crowd, but he would listen to the crowd, and that's how he decided that Dusty was going to be turning. He said, he didn't make the decision, apparently. The fans made the decision. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. They couldn't have kept Dusty heel. The fans would turn him, and Eddie was a master manipulator, and he knew it. And he knew just when to pull it, too. Because you can go too far. I'll give you an example. Remember when Sabu and Taz did that? Before they wrestled, they drew that thing out. If they had gone another month, that thing would have flopped. But Dusty was Eddie's boy, too. And Eddie got to him and said, hey, we're going to make the turn, and we're going to make it in Tampa. And Eddie had mapped it out step by step to do the turn. And he did. That's the thing. He did listen to the people because the people wanted somebody. And it was the exact opposite of what they had been given as a babyface from Jack Briscoe to Dusty.
Right.
Jack was a consummate wrestler. Dusty was a consummate showman. And it was brilliant on the office's part because sometimes it's hard when you're replacing a guy to go completely opposite. And if you don't, you make it almost impossible for the other guy to get over. So if they had gone, we'll say, Morocco was in and out of there at the time as a babyface. If they had gone to Morocco as the lead babyface, who looked so much like Jack at the time, it would put undue stress on Don Morocco. And I don't think he never would have gone over like Dusty did. Dusty was a phenomenon.
Well, let me ask you, you know, in an era where kayfabe was absolutely embedded in the industry, how much about this expected turn did you guys in the dressing room know? Or was it, were you kept in the dark and you just didn't find out until that? I mean, I'm sure you suspected that something was getting ready to happen, but was it something that was talked about in the dressing room or no?
Well, I think that everybody knew, like you guys were saying, that he couldn't be held as a heel anymore. I mean, they were starting to chant his name. And pop from when he walked down the aisle. And, you know, you'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to understand they were going to pull the trigger. But Eddie pulled it in the right building, too. You said there were 6,000 people, so in Tampa Armory, that would have been to the roof. And they filmed it, as he always did. And it was over instantaneously. Because there was something the people wanted. You know, we talk about today's era with wrestling fans who are much smarter, you know, they're all smart, want something and we don't give it to them. Well, back in the day, you know, I'm not going to say people believe, but they had a willing suspension of disbelief. And it was Dusty. And the territory was based on violence and also wrestling. They went hand in hand. People always say Florida was a wrestling territory. Yes, it was, but it was violence and blood on top that drew the money. And wrestling was what gave it its credibility. And Dusty took, we had seen the Jack Briscoe era of 90-minute matches with Dory Funk, Holly Race, Terry Funk, and then Dusty came along with his great showmanship and turned it a different way, and they didn't look back.
Yeah, and those typically, too, and looking at the gates, the Dusty houses really drew tremendously. And it looked like it went from, I've always said this too, Kevin, that it went from Eddie Graham to Jack Briscoe, and then from Jack Briscoe went to Paul Jones and then Dusty Rhodes. And Paul Jones was a very small window, kind of that bridge between Jack Briscoe and Dusty, and I don't think Paul was the guy long-term, obviously, but those houses underneath Dusty, especially right after the turn, you know, you're talking sellouts all across the state. So what was it like? Right. What was it like working for Bill Watts at the time? And Bill Watts has to get some of this responsibility because Bill Watts was doing things there. I remember the billboard in Tampa, which would have Gary Hart in his army, and, you know, we're trying to collect a bounty on Dusty Rhodes. And I don't recall up until the WWE or WCW, I don't recall anybody ever utilizing billboards before. So how was Bill Watts' role in this entire thing? How important was he to this?
I don't want to diminish Bill's role at all. That thing that he did with the billboards was brilliant. But Bill was a great listener, and he listened to a T. That was all directed by Eddie. All of it. I mean, I don't care who was the booker at any different time, whether it's Watts, Dusty, Funk, myself, on Tuesdays, Eddie was the booker. And the more you listened to Eddie, you understood that it started in Tampa and it spread through the rest of the territory. And I'm not diminishing Bill's role at all. You know, the billboards, I don't think Eddie would have done, but Eddie and Bill probably sat down, I'm sure they did, and mapped this out for there being no mistakes on Dusty. No mistakes on Dusty. So Bill did a great job, and then led it to him. He always said he went to college in New York with Vince McMahon Sr., and then he got his PhD with Eddie Graham. And then he went on from there to, you know, his own territory in Louisiana and blew that away. And Bill was a real good thinker and a real smart guy, and he understood so much the importance of what he does and how you have to have a babyface fighting from the bottom. And what better babyface to fight from the bottom than Dusty, because Dusty, we don't have to mention his talking. Dusty's one of the greatest of all times.
Well, let me ask you, Kevin, as important as Dusty, of course, was, and, you know, putting asses in the seats, he had the foil of Pak Song Nam, and you talked about, you know, here you know, you have the America that at the time was going through some troubles with the Nixon White House and all that kind of stuff. And here Dusty's coming out as the American dream, and you've got the foreign menace, but the foreign menace represented by Playboy Gary Hart. How important was Gary Hart to this whole scenario?
It works so well because if you ever watch Gary Hart, some managers, there's always a little bit of a twinkle in their eye when they're doing something like, hey, I know you guys are in on this. Gary played his role like Lee Van Cleef in The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. He was dead ass serious.
That is great.
That's a great analogy, no question.
Yes, that is great.
Yeah, he just was so serious. Because I'm not discounting any great managers, J.J. Kump, Bobby Heenan. There'd be times there was a twinkle in their eye, you know what I mean? When Dusty would come in and give you the flip-flop and fly, and then J.J. would take the holly-golly, there was a little bit of showmanship in there. With Gary, it was... He was a cold-blooded killer, and you got that. And it was one of those things that Dusty would have got over with any other manager, and he did in different times, but Gary was the catalyst to make that work, and the time, too. The country wasn't feeling good about itself. Along comes this son of a plumber who has a lisp, and he can talk, sounds like a book preacher. So everything just fell into place for them.
Yeah, and so I'm going to shift a little bit too, Kevin. So when you were first in Florida, which I believe was late 72 when you first came in, and then you formed a tag team with Mike Graham. You were multiple time Florida tag team champions, feuding with the original Samoans, Reno Tafuli and Tio Tio for 6 months, I think, and trading the titles back and forth. And then you stuck around, you left, you came back in 77, had a brief run, and then we didn't see you again, and then you came back in the early 80s, and obviously it's when things really started to change, and at this point, you came back as a babyface and then became the main event heel, and really that run lasted off and on for the next 4 to 5 years. So how much... of when you came in too, how much of your early time spent in Florida in the 70s was in the back of your head when you came in and really started to book as well in the 80s? How much of that, you know, how much of that early training stayed with you for your time as a main event heel in the 80s?
Uh, I was very lucky that when I came in, I kind of fit the part. Mike had just started. They put us together as a team. But Eddie took a liking to me and brought me into the office, and I would be listening to what he said, and he'd be calling all the promoters. And I understood that he and Funk Sr. had this unique... Eddie copied everything Funk Sr. did, meaning the Sheriff's Boys Ranch, keeping it legit wrestling, but you got to draw with violence. You open the show with a good wrestling match. You pepper it with political stuff, where the mayor of Tampa gave me and Mike an award for our work with the youth in Florida. They gave Eddie a flag. If a police officer got killed, there was a donation to his family. So even if you didn't like wrestling and you're going to knock it, when you saw that positive stuff he was doing with the community, you'd say, they turn a blind eye. And then they would get caught into the wrestling. And like I said, they would get caught in the willing suspension of disbelief. And I never said this before, but when wrestlers became promoters, the only one that didn't kill his own territory was Eddie. He stopped wrestling at about 41 years old. He was only wrestling part-time then. The Sheik, who was a dear, dear friend of mine, you know, he wrestled forever. Vern Gagne was still wrestling with Nick Bockwinkel. When Hogan was up there and they wouldn't give him the belt, they kept the younger guys down, where Eddie opened the door for younger guys. He saw the business in a different light, that he saw, hey, I'm getting older. I need young talent to keep this going, and I need to keep this fresh. Where if you look at Gagne's territory, it was the same guys. And they came there and they stayed there. And that's why I think for Vern, it was so easy for him to lose the territory. And the Sheik, too, it was the same match over and over again. You know, the Sheik wrestled, I think, about 173 times in Toronto and never lost.
Right.
So they wanted, and Dick Bruiser was the same way. I mean, so Eddie had a leg up on them. And I think, you know, we were talking about Watts earlier. I think Watts learned that because he stepped back from being a wrestler, where, you know, it takes a guy that understands the business to say, I'm not the guy I used to be. It's time for me to get in the background and do what I do best, manipulate this stuff.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. And I know that over in Japan, that's one of the things that Giant Baba was credited with, was that he gave his spotlight to Jumbo Tsuruta. He stepped back,
right,
and that so helped his promotion move forward. And, you know, but of course, you know, you say that about Eddie, and from the 70s, that was certainly the case, and into the early 80s. But, you know, when you start talking about the middle part of the 80s, as the business began to change, do you think Eddie had trouble adapting to the changes that were going on in the business?
I think I can remember when TBS went nationwide, and I had a talk with Eddie. He said, this is the beginning of the end. And he's right. Because no matter, this is going back to the time of Tommy Rich, no matter the great, we were landlocked. Nobody saw anything outside of Florida, right? When the TBS came and they saw Tommy Rich, it was, wow, he's on a national channel. We want to see him. And Eddie's was smart enough to see that the Alliance members had such big egos that they couldn't stick together and ward off this battle. I think he knew invariably it was going to go. And he knew nothing that he could do to stop it. Because I believe Florida was the last territory that Vince went in. Because Vince Sr. and Eddie had been so close.
Gotcha. Here's a question I've always wanted to ask you, Kevin, and I'm actually very happy that I got you on the phone. So looking at some of the last days of CWF, and you were there. You were there when the territory and I guess we should clarify it. Was the territory bought out by Crockett? Did Crockett take it? I've heard mixed, you know, everybody seems to have a different story, but you were there. What happened at the very end of CWF?
From what I could gather, was that Crockett was going to lease it and then later on buy it. But I think what happened was, well, they had been used to, and this is no disrespect to anybody, they had been used to seeing Dusty Rhodes, Terry Funk, Billy Graham, you know, everybody, Steve Kern, Briscoe, Mike Graham, and then Jimmy was sending in his C talent, T.J. Khan, the Mod Squad. And this is no disrespect to those guys. They were just starting. They couldn't go in those positions on top like they did. And they had plucked everybody out of Florida. Blackjack, Dusty went first, but Blackjack, Barry, Mike Rotunda, Black Bart, Ron Bass, Scott McGee, and a host of others. So all of a sudden, it was a skeleton crew, and it wasn't going to last. And Eddie had passed on, and Duke Kiyomoka and Hiro Matsuda didn't have enough connections in the wrestling business to stop Crockett from taking it over. So it became an afterthought, and, you know, you think, here's a territory that was the most viable territory next to New York for 30 years, or almost 30 years, and it was swallowed up inside of 4 to 6 months.
One of the guys, too, that, so when you came back and you had been gone, I think you were in Continental for a bit,
right.
and then you came back to Florida, and it looks like you were bringing a couple of guys from Continental with you, but here's a name that I saw on the ads listed in the newspaper and on the programs, but I don't have one record of him ever working a match in Florida, and that is Chris Colt. Did Chris Colt ever make it to CWF?
No, he didn't.
Okay.
Because he's heard, or somebody told, or I might even mentioned it to him, that it was over. And he stayed at Continental for a while. You know, nobody really knows who Chris Colt is today, but his bumps were extraordinary. I mean, anybody that ever saw Chris work, I mean, his bumps were up there with Ray Stevens. Fabulous worker, but yeah, and Barry, if you look closely, there's probably a couple other names that didn't come too, because now you weren't getting booked through the Tapper office, you were getting booked through Dusty. So rather than him bringing a guy in, he was sending the talent, the extra talent they had, down to Florida.
Okay, let me ask you next question. So as we look back on this, you know, I found myself thinking, you know, as Barry talked about going from Eddie to Jack to Dusty, and Dusty breaks out, becomes a national star. He's still got the base in Florida. And then you were talking about the problems that some promoters had with having trouble giving up that top spot, whether it was the Sheik or Vern Gagne or whatever. How difficult do you think it was, or maybe you know the answer to this question, how difficult was it for Eddie when he walked away from the top spot not to hand that spot to Mike? Because Mike in the ring was every bit as good as any of the other guys there. But, of course, there would have been that perception, hey, he's getting that spot because he's dad's boy. So how tough was that for Eddie not to give that spot to Mike?
Well, here's the thing. You know how great a work Mike was. Ric Flair puts him on his top five opponents. And back in the day, size mattered. And he didn't want to put the extra added pressure on Mike because he felt that the size was going against him and what you said, the Graham name. He didn't want it to be nepotism, and he got the belt. Mike was a fabulous performer, but Mike took it because he said, you know, I'm not the right size, and he knew it. And he said, I'm part of the company, so I'm going to get guys over. He was a real businessman.
But yeah,
I was going to say, I think that shows Eddie's genius because he's the only guy that didn't push his kid.
Yeah. And it's something that whenever this comes up, and you can generally tell if people, because, you know, again, growing up and watching this, Mike was only pushed to a certain degree. He wasn't really working the main event, sometimes in a tag match. But for the most part, the focus was on Dusty, or it was on, you know, Don Morocco, Jack, but whoever it was. But Mike was never pushed to the roof, and Mike didn't win the Florida title. He'd been in the business for 10 years before he finally won the Florida title, which I believe was 1982. So I have to agree with you with that, is that, you know, I always feel it's unjust. People will say, oh, Mike, only in wrestling because of who his father was. And it's like, you know what, you have no fucking idea what you're talking about, because as somebody that was in the arenas on a weekly basis, Mike was over. Mike was super over with the people, and an excellent worker. So, Kevin, let me ask you a question too. You're a guy, you've had a career now that goes back, you know, I don't want to give out your age, because you're still in your 40s, if I'm correct, Kevin. So I don't want to screw this up, but you've had a career. Exactly. You're still 39. So you've had a career. So what's the one, if I had to say to you, okay, look, you were a booker in arguably, you know, one of the biggest wrestling companies in the world. You headlined territories. You had a very creative mind. You wrote your own ticket in a lot of ways as well, because you were such a bright guy in the business. What's the one thing that you never accomplished that you always wish you could have done in professional wrestling?
I take the Cecil Page line, never look back, something maybe gain it. I always think that tomorrow's another day. And I try to live in the moment, because if you look back in the past, it's what could have been, not what's going to be. So I got no regrets.
Gotcha. You did tell me a story once too, and I think you were really our featured guest at CWF Legends Fan Fest 2 when you were there with J.J. Dillon. But I remember you telling a story about how you were, interviewing for a position in the office in the WWE. I don't know if it was a booker or you know, whatever it was, but I remember this was a great story. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Which, when they brought me up to go run if I was interested?
Yes.
The thing was, at the time, I had just started the gym. The gym was doing well. And are you talking about when they asked me, you know, what I had done?
Yes.
Yeah, so one of them in the office said to me, well, I really don't know what you've done. And I said, well, ask your dad. So, you know, they didn't take that too positive. So sometimes you have to know when to hold them and when to show them. And I think I showed them when I should have hold them. So it got me a little bit of heat, but we just go on. That's what I mean. You make mistakes, and everybody makes them. If you dwell on them and not learn from them, you made a mistake. If you learn from them, you know, you grow. So sometimes it's better to shut your mouth, and I've learned that the hard way, I think, a couple of times.
Yeah, and before I forget, I want to give a plug too. So Kevin is going to be on November the 9th. He is going to be in Orlando, Florida for USA Professional Wrestling. Kevin Sullivan returning to Orlando. And Kevin, any other appearances coming up over the next couple of months?
Yeah, I'm in Ripley, Mississippi in October. I'm in Dayton, Indiana in September. So I've been moving around some. I took, you know, the summer I take off most of the time, so, and enjoy myself. So I'm glad to see that the wrestling business is going to take an upswing turn, I think. And I don't know what you guys think, but I think this Fox thing is going to be huge for them. I think it's going to be presented more of like a sport if what they say in Fox is true. Do you think that's what they're going to do? Because it's going to be presented besides football and baseball and UFC and boxing, isn't it?
Well, I don't really know if Vince has that in his wheelhouse. Do you really think he has it in his wheelhouse at his age to chain what he's presenting?
Well, what I'm saying is, isn't Fox kind of directing this? I mean, we hit all these different rumors, but I heard Fox has said they wanted it more presented more like a sport. Do you think that will happen?
Well, let me ask you this question. I'll flip it on you. If Eddie had been offered a spot about 1978 or 79 when TBS was breaking national and he said, we'll give you a national platform, but you have to present it as entertainment, what do you think Eddie would have said?
He would have said no.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. That Vince, that's not what he knows.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I never even kind of put that in my head, but you're right.
Yeah. And, now that being said, the All Elite stuff, the New Japan becoming more of a recognized name in this country, all that competition is good because if it provokes Triple H and Vince to keep their product more flowing and stuff like that and not become lazy, if it kicks them in the ass, that's always good for the product to have the head honcho get a kick in the ass and reminded that he needs to keep his product fresh.
Well, I'm going to tell you what I think is going to be the kick in the ass. I watched the UFC fight the other night. I just came in this morning from Boston. And I don't know if it was an old UFC fight because I was getting ready to go to bed. And it was Cyclops. Is that the girl's name?
Cyborg.
Cyborg. And another girl. And they were beating each other to death, right? And then last week, or 2 weeks ago, out of Florida, they had the first pay-per-view of a bare knuckle boxing. Did you see that?
No, I did not see that.
They did 100,000 buys with no names.
Wow.
And boxing, heavyweight boxing is as healthy now as it was during Ali's heyday. The last six fights they've had at Wembley Stadium, the lowest has been 90,000 people.
Hmm.
We get a lot of competition now with combat sports that are legit or presented as legit. Let's put it that way. I think we need to make some kind of adjustment if we're going to compete, because every time, like, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, that bare-knuckle boxing was banned in every state but one. Now the ban's been lifted, and, as consumers, we're monkey see, monkey do. So 100,000 people bought at this fight. If they get somebody with a UFC background that meant something or a wrestling background, we'll say if it was Ming in the day, and they had a bare knuckle fight, they're going to draw some money. So the competition for the entertainment dollar / sports dollar gets tighter and tighter. So I think they're going to have to go back to some kind of different presentation because they get competition all around them. It isn't just the Elite. It isn't just New Japan. It's UFC, couple of other MMA groups, it's pro boxing, it's the bare knuckle boxing, and how much money is there can be spread around for the entertainment dollar. And that's where I think we're going to see things have to change. And like you said, with New Japan and All Elite, I think these guys are going to have to hone up their game.
Sure, that's a valid point. So let me ask you, first of all, we certainly appreciate you taking time out. As you said, you just flew in today, and you've taken some time with us, and we are very appreciative of you doing that, Kev. So here's a question I asked Barry earlier in the show, and I want to get your response without telling you what Barry's answer was, okay?
Okay.
People always talk about a Mount Rushmore, okay, Mount Rushmore, the greatest players in Red Sox history or Yankees or sports. So tell me, if you were going to do a Mount Rushmore of CWF over the course of its history, tell me who the four guys are you're having on that mountaintop.
Eddie Graham, Jack Briscoe, Dusty Rhodes, and Terry Funk.
All right. Barry, you want to tell them who yours were?
Yeah, and I had five. How many people are, is it four on the mount, or is it five?
It's four. Apparently you're on Mount Everest, Barry.
I'm on Mount Everest, where I put five up there, because it's a bigger mount, okay. So I figure I could do that. So I had Eddie Graham, Dusty Rhodes, Jack Briscoe, Gordon Solie, and Cowboy Luttrell would be the five.
That's very good. I forgot about Gordon. Gordon definitely be my fifth.
Yeah, and he was a guy that I just said was so intertwined with the history of the promotion. You know, a guy that never set foot in the ring, but he meant so much to the promotion. I mean, there's no way you can keep him off it. But, I mean, I didn't include guys that were necessarily outside the ring. So now here's another question I asked Barry that I'll be interested in. Taking yourself out of the equation, because, of course, you did have a legendary feud with Dusty Rhodes. So when you think back on Dusty Rhodes' best rival of all time, give me four or five names, and then give me the one that you think was his ultimate number one rival.
I'll give you the one first, Terry Funk.
Boom! And that's exactly what I said, Kevin. There you go.
Yeah. I mean, we all bow to Terry. I mean, after Terry, it's Terry, then the rest of us, you know. But, I mean, Terry, Pak Song, you know, and you got to put Pak Song up there, even though he was the one that kicked it off. He was a granddaddy. He was Harry Freese, you know, the guy that traded Babe Ruth to the Red Sox. I mean, from the Red Sox, you know. He's the one that started the American Dream. So him, Terry, I guess, superstar Billy Graham, because it went nationwide, right?
Yep.
And maybe Abdullah.
So Barry, why don't you tell him the ones that you mentioned that he hasn't?
Yeah, absolutely too. So we agreed on Terry Funk. We agreed on superstar Billy Graham. And I believe, because Superstar says this, that Dusty said that was one of his favorite opponents to work with. You're obviously on the list as well. I also put up the Assassin and the Missouri Mauler. Because I thought those two really had something. And Pak Song we also agreed on. So I think it was, Jeff, what was the difference? Was it the Assassin and Missouri Mauler that I said?
Well, I think you're leaving out Ernie Ladd.
And Ernie Ladd, right, exactly. I said Ernie Ladd as well, which is also a great feud that he had.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes,
so,
it was.
So, well, Sully, we certainly appreciate your time. Hey, wanted to ask you, while you were in Boston, I know you spent a little time there. Yeah. If you're going to Boston, outside of seeing the Red Sox, maybe visiting some family, what restaurant are you going to go have dinner at in Boston?
I go to the Ye Olde Union Oyster House. It's been in existence from, I think, 1760. And the doorways, it shows you how small the people were in the doorways. I even have to duck my head. And it's a great seafood place. And then there's Jimmy's by the harbor side. And the Charter House. There's a lot of great restaurants there. You know, you can't go wrong. Great seafood. Yep. But I'd put the Seattle seafood above Boston seafood.
Really? Now, that's breaking kayfabe right there, buddy.
Yeah.
And Kevin, do you like ice cream? Do you eat a lot of ice cream at all?
Yeah, I love ice cream.
There is a place in Boston. I was in Boston not last summer, the summer before, and somebody turned me on to a place called J.P. Licks. Have you ever heard of this company? There are like 16 or 17 in around Boston and I guess the suburbs, and that was some of the best. They had a flavor. It was Nomar Garcia Cherry or something, named after the baseball player, but it was full of, it was like the best fucking ice cream I'd ever had in my life, Kevin. Have you ever been to this spot, J.P. Licks?
No, I haven't, but there used to be an ice cream place called Bedford Farms. And ice cream was made in the town of Bedford and made by their own cows. And this is before people were into organic stuff, but it was all organic and it was unbelievable. They had a thing called a bucket, and there was two scoops of vanilla, two scoops of chocolate, two scoops of strawberry, and then they had fresh strawberries, fresh pineapple, bananas, and homemade whipped cream on it. Oh, to die for.
All right. Well, listen, hey, buddy, we certainly want to give you our thanks for taking time out of your day. As I said, you flew back in and you agreed to be on the show with us, and we really appreciate it because we wanted to know what it was like, feet on the ground there at the Hesterly Armory the night that Dusty turned. And Kevin Sullivan, on behalf of Bear, we really appreciate your time, my man.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. You have a good one.
Bye-bye.
So one of the other things that happened this week, Barry, that involves our very own Lord Barron's Rose, was the release of the Big History of CWF DVD. And we both have had a chance to look at it, and I definitely have some opinions on it. Barry, since you were involved with the DVD, why don't you tell us a little bit about how they approached you and some of your thoughts on the making of the DVD?
Yeah, absolutely, too. And it's really interesting, too, in that there are actually two different documentaries being filmed on the history of CWF. And the first one, and I'm not sure which came first. I think the released version of the High Spots documentary is the first one. But there is another documentary that is being done by Lynn Marvin Dingfelder. Her husband just won a political seat in Tampa. I think he's a city council member. I don't know exactly, but she's an Emmy award-winning documentary filmmaker, and she partnered up with Jody Simon, Jody Malenko, about 4 years ago. And when he did the big fundraiser to get money to put up the wall, which is not a Hall of Fame, but a Wall of Fame, which is in the old Fort Homer Hesterly Armory, which is now the JCC, they partnered up and she was there filming. And then about a year and a half, 2 years ago, she released the trailer. And if you haven't seen it, it's phenomenal. I mean, it was just phenomenal. But she is taking her time. So in the meantime, High Spots came out with a documentary. And I was approached by Michael Elliott. Michael is a guy, he's done a lot of these documentaries, and he's kind of the guy that produces a lot of original content for High Spots. So there's been documentaries on the funk, the history of the Mid-Atlantic area. He's done a lot of different shoots and stuff like that. So he approached me, and this was probably about 3 years ago, and said, hey, I'm looking at doing this. Would you be able to, give me some guidance? And, and obviously, that's something I fully embrace. So I kind of worked with him on this over the last 3 years. When I say worked with him, I sent him shit. I didn't really do any of the physical work other than the interview that you saw. And I got to tell the interview too. So we've been trying to coordinate, for probably 2 years, and we could never coordinate. And he and his wife drove up, and they checked into a lovely hotel about 2 miles from my house. And I think it was last September or October, I actually went over to the hotel, and we recorded for probably 2 hours, maybe 2 to 3 hours. And it was interesting. And, he's a guy who grew up, I think, watching the Mid-Atlantic territory. So not a guy that had a lot of points of reference for CWF. But, he's interviewed, and you can see that in this, too. He's interviewed so many guys that he was able to really formulate what I thought was a well-crafted DVD and a well-crafted documentary. And our own Josh Dunn getting a shout-out, I think for the first time, too, but Josh was the first one to post on our Facebook page, which is the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook group. If you're not a member, I fully encourage you to join, because it is a literal extension of what we talk about every week, and it just, the party continues.
Over 1,400 members now, Barry.
And it's active, and that's the thing. When we say 1,400, it's not 1,300 people sleeping on their hands. There's people in there night, day, around the clock, and these are passionate, passionate people. And it is, you could be having, and I've posted, you could be having the worst fucking day of your life, and you get into our group, and something is going to make you laugh out loud. And honestly, I think Josh Dunn is responsible, because when he started doing these screen captures of me, all of a sudden there were a million memes that came out of me, and they were all fucking fucking hysterical. And then you got they jumped you. They brought you in and they made you a superhero. I think it was like Hurrit Bowdrin or something. But we just had a blast with that. But I think Josh Dunn was responsible for getting the word out for this DVD. And he's a real champion of professional wrestling, whether it's old school or new school. And I really respect that because it's a true love and passion. And you can see it every time he posts something. And I have the utmost respect for that. So getting back to the DVD. So it is a very compelling look, I think, at the history of CWF. Is it perfect? It is not perfect. And that is, you know, that's, I guess, with a critical eye. But, you know, I talked with Michael after the fact and I said, you know, how did you feel about the DVD? Were you happy with it? And he goes, I was happy, but I could have been happier. And I think that's the way it goes, you know. I think if you're a real filmmaker, that's probably the stance you're going to take. You know, you're never going to fully be fucking satisfied with your work and stuff like that. So it was good. I sat down. I was able to watch it. It's a two-disc set for the DVD. Fully worth the price. I think it's $20. And I mean, absolutely 100% worth the price. He interviewed quite a lot of guys, and a lot of it was done not specifically for this DVD. So like the Terry Funk interview, I believe, was done prior for maybe the Funk Brothers DVD. And then I know that he's also purchased footage from other people that do shoots that shall remain nameless. And he incorporated all this footage. But there were some stories in here. And I think from an accuracy standpoint, I think it's very accurate, a lot of what he put forth. I know when you and I were talking, you definitely had some opinions on it. And I think the one thing that you and I agree with was the Eddie Graham suicide story. And I'll tell you, it really hits me, and I'll tell you, and then I definitely want to get your thoughts on it, because I know you were moved by it, and that really, you know, Eddie Graham, I met Eddie Graham. I was a kid, but I had zero relationship with Eddie Graham. I got to know Mike Graham in the later years, after I had the CWF Archives website. He had actually reached out to me and he wanted to sell DVDs of the old footage of the old TV shows through my website. I said, absolutely. I would be on. That's awesome. He was going to give me copies, which is what I wanted. But as it turns out, he wound up selling it to the WWE for like $1 million. Smart move.
Are you saying you could not have met that offer? You could not have matched the move? Because I know Open Table is paying you pretty well, Barry.
Yeah, sure. No, he was a very, very smart. He didn't even consult with me. It was like all of a sudden I'm talking with Mike on a fairly frequent basis, and then it just went dead cold. Fully understandable why he did it. And then Mike obviously took his own life as well. But I am, and as Jeff as you are, we are both friendly with the daughter of Mike Graham, who is the granddaughter of Eddie Graham, obviously. And she's a fantastic person. And to tell you that she has been through a lot, she is a non-wrestling person. She is a civilian. She is married. She has a young daughter. And she's lost her grandfather. She's lost her father. She's lost her brother to suicide. She also lost her uncle. So she lost four family members to suicide. And that's something that hopefully you and I will never be able to comprehend in any form. So I'm always very hesitant when people come out and want to discuss the suicide of Eddie Graham, because a lot of it tends to be very sensationalistic. And quite frankly, she doesn't deserve that. And I fucking hate it. I absolutely, you know, if you're trying to get your ratings off of somebody's death, or just, you know, that to me, you're a bottom feeder, go fuck yourself. I absolutely hate it. So I was really hesitant. That being said, this was for the most part handled right. But Jeff, give me your thoughts on this.
Well, first of all, I did not know that the story. I mean, of course, I knew that Eddie had killed himself, but the story about the second shot was something that I was completely unaware of, and completely horrified that the first shot did not kill him. You know, according to the storyline, basically blew away half of his face, his lower, you know, the jaw on one side of his face, and then he shot himself again. Now there was some conflict as to whether or not he put the gun into his mouth, or whether he put it to the side of his head. Regardless, you know, and then it still didn't kill him. You know, oh my God, it's just like so fucking horrifying, you know, to know that, you know, Mike went to the hospital and had to hear that his father had tried to kill himself twice within, you know, a span of what, 30 seconds, hadn't succeeded. And Mike making the decision, knowing the way his father was and knowing that his father absolutely would not want to live that way, along with his stepmother making the difficult decision to, you know, to not resuscitate his father. It's just, it's a horrifying story, but it's completely gripping too, you know, and in large part because I did not know about that aspect of the story. But wow, yeah, that was something. I literally sat there with my jaw dropped open when I heard that part of the story, Barry. I don't know if that was common knowledge. If it was, somehow it managed to slip right past me because I didn't know that part of the story.
Yeah, so it did happen that way. It's not something that a lot of, you know, it just tends to be Eddie Graham committed suicide and that kind of ends it. But that is accurate. And then there's also the theory that Eddie Graham was murdered. And there, you know, after this DVD was released, I think I got three messages from people. What do you think? Do you think it was suicide? Do you think he was murdered? And, you know, everybody speculates, why did Eddie Graham kill himself? And when really, when somebody commits suicide, it's never, you know, you can't say, oh, it's because of this, it's because of that. You know, there are problems that mount up. And obviously, you know, what he had built along with Cowboy Luttrell, you know, his entire life was professional wrestling from A to Z. That was everything. And that was leaving him quickly. You know, he saw the writing on the wall. As Kevin Sullivan told us, Jeff, Eddie saw that, you know, years before 1985, when he actually killed himself. There were some bad real estate deals. There were a lot of rumors. People will say they're not rumors, but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they're still rumors, but rumors that he was involved with some very shady people. Billy Jack Haynes, and, you know, you might want to take what Billy Jack Haynes says with a grain of salt or not, but Billy Jack Haynes has a lot of theories on what happened with Eddie Graham, fully believes that he was murdered, saying that it would have been impossible for him to fire off the second shot after the first shot, and that because of the people that he was involved with, which Billy claims he was also involved with these people, that they actually had Eddie Graham killed. I'm going to stay with the suicide. But again, you know, I don't know. I know what I know, and there could be a lot more out there that we don't know.
Okay, so now let me give some other thoughts. And honestly, I'd sent these thoughts to Barry when I first watched it. And one of the comments I made was, there are parts of this DVD that I really, really liked, and then there were some other parts that I kind of cringed at. And, you know, as much as I found the story interesting, that story about Eddie is a little cringeworthy, though, because you hear, you know, if in fact the suicide theory is true, that the man shot himself twice before he, you know, went into a coma or became brain dead, that's just completely horrifying. Some other thoughts I had, Black Bart featured prominently. I got to be honest with you. If I'm looking for a DVD about the history of championship wrestling from Florida, Black fucking Bart is not where I'm going. Okay. And to make it worse, Black Bart is like kind of, well, you know, I'm and then I went down. I'm like, really? This is the guy that you've decided to interview? Because one of the other comments I made was, you're doing a history on the CWF. Okay. Let's be honest. Let's take a look at some of the people they did not interview. And there were a lot of interviews, okay? And some of the stuff was very good. The stuff with Mike Graham, where they'd gone back to an old interview with Mike, that was very compelling. We had no Buddy Colt. We had no Bill Watts. We had no Barry Windham. We had no Bob Roop. These are four guys that are, I don't know, I'm thinking about it. That's a pretty essential element of championship wrestling from Florida. Yet somehow, whether it was, you know, they couldn't make financial arrangements, they didn't have the time to do it, but, you know, how do you do a history of CWF and not include these four guys? It just kind of struck me as a little bit unbelievable, quite frankly. Let's see what else. Okay. I was sitting here thinking, maybe I should say this, maybe I shouldn't. Okay. I've been friends with Bruce Mitchell for over 30 years, and Bruce Mitchell is a great guy. He's one hell of a writer. Okay. Why Bruce Mitchell is on there commenting on CWF, though, I was like, really? Really? Because I'll be honest with you. If somebody calls me and says they want to do a history of Mid-Atlantic wrestling, I'm not a, I'm a historian, but I'm not the guy you should be talking to about CWF. You should be talking to Bruce or John Hitchcock or one of the guys that run the website, the Mid-Atlantic Gateway. So I don't understand why Bruce Mitchell was interviewed for the history of CWF wrestling when, you know, they had you. And not to blow smoke up your ass, Barry, but I thought you were very compelling. You did a great job. They could have gotten somebody like a Scott Teal. Oh, my God, I can't believe I'm about to say this. They could have gotten David fucking Penzer. They could have got somebody that had some background or could, you know, discuss. There are so many guys around. Think of all the guys that show up at our fan fest that were there for the history of CWF. And as much as I like Bruce and as much as I consider Bruce a good friend, I don't understand why Bruce Mitchell was part of this story, other than he would sit there and say, oh, yeah, that was a great angle when they did that. Yeah, it was really good stuff. You know, okay. Again, Mid-Atlantic, absolutely go to Bruce Mitchell. CWF, I'm sorry, there were guys you could have gone to before that. Okay, well, I got one more thing to say, Barry. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think we can say former friend Bruce Mitchell at this point. Right, but, you know, that's the way it goes. But, you're right. So let's say, so in defense of Bruce, or this is not in defense, in defense of the filmmaker, Bruce is convenient. Bruce is North Carolina. The filmmaker is based out of North Carolina. So it's simply a matter of getting FaceTime. He's right there. Probably has a relationship with him. And Bruce will have some notoriety coming from the torch and whatever else he's done. To your point, and I fully agree with you, actually, Scott Teal would have been a great choice, because not only is Scott Teal maybe the most prolific author in the history of professional wrestling, take out the newsletter that Meltzer does on a weekly basis, Scott Teal's produced like 150 books, and they're all a fucking quality at this point as well. So that would have been a guy that I would have looked at. Dave Meltzer, love him or hate him, Dave Meltzer knows his shit. He saw CWF in the 70s live. He had a grandparent that lived there, or both grandparents lived there. Jeff, you're a good choice as well. And you brought up David Penzer. I mean, say what you want. David Penzer grew up watching CWF in the 1970s and actually worked for a major wrestling company, actually two, and was with WCW for close to a decade. So he's got some stuff right there. So it was a little bizarre. No, thing.
And here's another guy. They could have done more doing an updated interview with Fonzie, you know, a guy that was as well known in the wrestling industry. There were guys they could have used. And I'm not making this pick on Bruce Mitchell time, but, you know, it just seemed like an odd choice, you know?
Yeah, that's okay if we want to pick on Bruce for a bit. I don't have a problem with that. I think we're
I'm going to have to make a phone call now.
Yeah, you may have to. But so Fonzie's, I'll tell you what's interesting about Fonzie. Fonzie, first off, would have done this. So they offered to pay me. I didn't take a penny because why would I? That's not, you know, it does it. But Fonzie's a guy that, even though he's a wrestling personality, probably would have done this for free. Fonzie's also close friends with the filmmaker. They have brought Fonzie to numerous conventions and have had him at the High Spots table. So Fonzie's enthusiasm as well as anybody. Fonzie showed up at the last fan fest just to be a part of it. You know, there was no agreement. There was no money exchanged. Fonzie's like, can I come tomorrow? It's like, yeah, we'll find a spot. We'll make it work. And we did. That's just the kind of guy he is. He's one of the greats. So I agree with you. You're right. Black Bart, again, I'm going with the Black Bart probably lives near the filmmaker and it was convenient. Somebody like Watts, maybe with the price tag was too high. BW might be the same. Bob Roop probably would have talked for free. I mean, I can almost guarantee that.
Would have also involved a third disc, because the way, you know, Bob likes to
Bob, did you hear that? it would be an additional 8 discs if Bob is involved, right? Bob, we're giving you, and Bob absolutely admits that and loves that when we discuss that with him as well, about that he can be long winded. And what a great guy. But I think your points are valid. I don't think these are points that they aren't. But I think it's also, you and I are going to look at a history of the CWF DVD, and we're gonna comb through it. We're gonna say, well, if I was doing it, I would have done this, and certainly, you're not gonna please me 100% with a CWF DVD. It just wouldn't be possible.
No, and
but overall, I think it is very good, though.
Oh, no, no. It's absolutely worth your time and money because there's some great stories. Again, I didn't know the Eddie Graham story. I think that's something that will come out of the blue for people that don't, you know, that aren't familiar with it. Very compelling. There's the second disc is really a series of interviews, again, from different sites that this guy has, you know, kind of put together. I'll tell you a complaint I had is towards the end of the second and we probably should mention that our friend Kevin Sullivan is also interviewed very prominently on this disc. But one of the things, the complaint I had was that towards the end of the second disc, there's an interview segment with you where you talk about how you made the decision to start the CWF Archives Facebook group and that, you know, when you take your last breath up into that point, you're still going to be discussing the history and doing your, you know, your best to advertise and promote and push the history of championship wrestling from Florida. And I found myself sitting there thinking this would be a perfect end to this DVD, you know, to show the passion and the love that you have, not just for the wrestling business, but specifically for CWF. And then they added on right at the end a sort of innocuous Brian Blair story that I felt was a little bit dry. And I thought they could have put that story anywhere in the middle of the disc two and, you know, let the disc end with you talking about your passion for CWF. And I felt as far as an edit, that was a poor way of editing that last disc. So now let me talk about one thing that I really love that really shocked the hell out of me. Let me tell you folks something. For the last 30 years, there has been no bigger critic in the pro wrestling sheet world, the online fandom that is pro wrestling, whether it's the Observer, you know, our group, John McAdams groups, lots of other groups. Nobody has been more critical of Lex fucking Luger than Jeff Bowdrin. Okay. That being said, I watched the interview where he talks about a rib that Barry Windham played on him. And I absolutely just started laughing out loud. Lex Luger, the guy that's on this disc, I said, where the fuck was this guy when he was wrestling? Because this guy was entertaining as hell, Barry. Where did this Lex come from?
Yeah, and that's really funny, too. And he was, you know what, in Lex's defense, you know, there's a lot of, so a lot of people either find religion and we know that it's not real. We know that it's fake. Lex almost died. He's disabled. He is in a wheelchair. He's got very serious physical issues. I believe there's not a lot of money. I know that he was living with a pastor, like in a pastor's house, because he didn't have money. I truly believe, and by all accounts, Lex was a prick years ago. I fully believe that he is a good person right now. And whether it was, you know, what we saw, because that was a great story that he told. But all the stories I've heard of people that deal with Lex at this point, he's a really good guy. And quite frankly, I feel terrible the fact that, you know, he's going through what he goes through. Those spirits seem great. Jeff, but it was a great story. There's a little sidebar to this story, Jeff. Do we want to discuss the texting you were doing the other night? I just thought that was hysterical based off of last week's show.
Sure, go ahead.
Gotcha. So Jeff was really taken with a few things on this documentary. One was the Eddie Graham suicide. We both liked it. The one thing we didn't like, and I think we can say, there is a scene where there is a hand going for a gun. We felt that was a little gratuitous, but otherwise, this was a very compelling story. Black Bart maybe featured a little too prominently for a guy that had a short stay in CWF. Bruce Mitchell, we've already covered. But Lex Luger was really the kind of revelation for you. And you texted me and you were like, why didn't we ever see this side of Lex before? This was great. And Jeff was so taken with Lex that he reached out to our old friend Nick Massey to get Lex's contact info to try to get him on the show. And Nick responds, you have to go through his agent. His agent's name, Tony Hunter. Tony Hunter that we ripped mercilessly last week. So Jeff just saw that and said, oh, fuck, we're done. That was it. So we didn't reach out to Lex, though. I would still love to get Luger on.
Yes, anybody out there that knows Lex Luger.
It's Chris Aha coming in his shorts, Jeff. when I say that we're trying to get Luger on the show, so
anybody that wants to put Lex in touch with Barry or I, feel free, because I said anybody that would love to have that would love to put us in touch with Lex Luger without having to go through Tony Hunter, we would love to talk to Lex, because I would love to put over this DVD by talking about it more with Lex and the stories that he told. Again, I'm not gonna tell the story, but just wait for the great story about the trick that BW played on him once. It was very funny, and it really, in a way that I'd never seen before with Lex Luger, it really humanized Lex Luger to me, you know. And again, I feel terrible that this guy's going through what he's going through now. He's, like you said, he's in a wheelchair. It definitely showed a side of Lex Luger that I don't think that we have ever seen before. So our strongest recommendation on this, if for no other reason that you get to see Barry Windham. You know, I knew it was a couple years ago because I thought I saw a few hairs on the top of that head, Barry. And I was going, young Barry Rose here was still a little bit of hair.
No, it was makeup. They brought out that shit in a can, and they were spraying the top of my head with it, like the Ron Popeil hair in a can or something. But really, it was just, I think it was like, you know, it was less than a year ago. I think it was like last fall, maybe even into winter. And you can order this DVD also, The History of the Championship Wrestling from Florida, via High Spots. I believe it is $19.99. They also have a streaming service, I believe that's $10 a month, where you can see it. And again, I want to thank Josh Dunn for really going the distance. And I think partly, too, supporting DVDs and documentaries like this will continue that that people will keep making features like this. So I fully encourage you, for $20, if you want to learn about these old territories, God knows you've heard Jeff and I over the last 2 years talk a lot about CWF. This is really a great look at what the territory was about, how people cared about the territory, how people that worked in the territory cared, the fans cared, and we still care to this day. Obviously, I still care. There's not a day that goes by that something CWF related isn't clearly in my face. So support this. Support indie filmmakers and guys that are making documentaries.
Yeah, and I will say that I have mentioned this before, but besides the very worthwhile documentary, I have to tell you folks that are into YouTube, that like to watch the YouTube, 106 North Albany is definitely a channel on YouTube that you should go out of your way to find. They post shit, and I'm like, where did this guy find this? Just all kind of stuff from the mid-70s. None of the matches, you're not getting 30 minutes of action, but, you know, some of that 5 to 10 minute clip stuff, Barry, is just absolute friggin' gold.
It really is, too. And that was kind of part of the problem, is that they didn't really tape, or they did tape a lot of the matches, and then they would cut them down and edit them. So a 20-minute match would become a 5-minute match for television, and that's what we have. But you know what? You give me the opportunity to see a lot of this stuff from the 70s that's been lost. And we post 2 or 3 video clips per day in our Facebook group, which is the CWF group, and it really is amazing to sit there and watch it.
Yeah. Okay, so as we begin wrapping up, Barry, one last thing that hit myself very hard personally, and that was the other day we lost Rutger Hauer, the great actor, so famous as Roy Batty in Blade Runner. I totally blanked for a second there. 1982, the incredible film Blade Runner. Rutger Hauer, also a guy that starred in a movie called Soldier of Orange. He starred in Lady Hawk. He was the lead heel in the movie The Hitcher. He was in the Batman. I think Batman Begins. He had a role as kind of a heel corporate guy. God, what a friggin' body of work this guy had. And 75 years old. And as someone pointed out, Roy Batty, the character in the movie, died in 2019. And so did Rutger Hauer, Barry.
Yeah, that was I broke that to you. And I think it was like, sucks about Rutger Hauer. And that was one of those that hurt. And I'll tell you, he was, at least in my opinion. So I had seen him. I don't know if he's Swedish, the Netherlands.
I think he's maybe Dutch. Yeah.
He's Dutch, but he was in a movie called Spetters. And I saw this years ago, and it was probably 83 or 84. And they were playing at New York City. And it was really based off of the fact that everybody knew who Rutger Hauer was after seeing Blade Runner. So he was a really good actor. When he made The Hitcher to me is, I think, one of the most underappreciated or underrated horror films ever, because it's just so good from start to finish. I love the movie The Hitcher. Lady Hawk, which you brought up, Michelle Pfeiffer and Matthew Broderick, really a movie that gets little love or little play, but really good. But Rutger Hauer was one of those guys, and he's in a rare group of guys that – even if the movie wasn't good, having Rutger Hauer in the movie made it watchable. And I was really bummed. And the last thing that I saw him do, he was on True Blood, which probably goes back 6-7 years at this point. I don't even know. And it was a horrible storyline. He was like a fairy. I don't know. It was like the show is about vampires, and then it turned into fucking fairies. And I hated True Blood, the second half of it. But, even then, you know, he's delivering dialogue that's like written by like my 4-year-old nephew, but he still is able to stand out through his acting. So, you know what? We salute you, Rutger Hauer. You will always be Roy Batty, Jeff's favorite movie of all time. And, just a fucking, he was a star, man. This guy had it. He was an absolute star. He owned the screen when he was on the screen.
Yeah. So as we end this episode of Breaking Kayfabe with Baudrin and Barry, I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Baudrin Jeff, Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And I would duly want to note our friend Luke Kippelman on the production duties. And as a dedication to Rutger Hauer, I'm going to leave us with his memorable scene from the very end of Blade Runner. They call it the Tears and Rain speech. Rest in peace, Rutger Hauer.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears.